and to gather together, and we're enjoying some beautiful weather as the summer is over and about over, and we have Labor Day weekend this week, and some of our families are out of town, so we miss them. But we welcome our visitors again from Texas. Really appreciate both of you coming to be with us and sharing this time after your beautiful cruise that you went on. I want to remind us all that as we turn to God's Word, that is exactly what we are doing. We are, as the Apostle Paul reminded us and pointed out in 2 Timothy 3, that all Scripture is given by the inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine and for reproof and for instruction and correction in righteousness. So we are going to do that this morning. We'll turn to the Word of God in the Old Testament in the book of Ecclesiastes. And I would like to invite you to turn there. And the first chapter of Ecclesiastes. And we are going to look at the first two chapters here in this book. It is a book that I think is very relevant in our lives right now today. God's Word is always very relevant and speaks to us. But I think we all in life, as we live our lives, we wonder at times, what is my purpose? What is the purpose of why I am here? And what is it that I can do in my time that I have here on this earth to make something of significance or to accomplish something? To feel that my life has been well spent. And as we start out as young people, we have high hopes and ambitions. And you think about when we were in our graduation ceremony from high school and with our classmates and thinking about the future, we all had those high hopes and expectations of what life would be like for us. But as we go on through life, it seems like we begin to dawn on us the realization that everything stays the same, that we're not really changing anything, and that life begins to be sort of frustrating or even disappointing, that we haven't been able to accomplish more in our lifetime. And so we look at a book of Ecclesiastes here, and we find that the writer is speaking about these things that I'm talking about, the frustrations, the feeling that life is not all that we were hoping it would be. And we look at ourselves and we wonder, well, what is my purpose? What is it that I can be doing to be effective? Or so as we look at Ecclesiastes, we deal with some of those very questions that the writer here is asking for us to ponder and to think about. And as he is asking these questions, again, I want to emphasize that this is really the words of God that we are going to be considering here, and that these are inspired words. They may seem to be somewhat pessimistic as we look at some of the thoughts this morning in this lesson, but nevertheless, we need to consider the message that God is saying here, because it is intended for our benefit, and there is a wisdom that he has here that he wants to impart to all of us. So it begins in verse 1 with the words of the preacher. And he said, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now he begins to introduce himself here, but he doesn't really identify himself, other than to say that he was the son of David, he was the king in Jerusalem. And of course, there were many kings who were the descendants of David as king in Jerusalem, and the kingdom of Judah that later on for several hundred years, it could have been a number of individuals based on what he is saying here. But in verse 12, I think he identifies further for us, because he says, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel," in Jerusalem. Now, whenever there was a king in Jerusalem over Israel, there were only two kings. That was David and Solomon. Because after Solomon died, the kingdom divided, and it became known as the kingdom of Judah in Jerusalem. But he says here, "I was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I was the son of David." I was king over Israel. He also said, "I have obtained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem." So when we read that, I think we can see that it really has to be Solomon that he is describing and identifying himself in this way, and that he is the son of David who was king. He puts it in the past tense, so it evidently is being written at the late time of his life, not long before he died. So he's looking back over his life, and there are things that he has experienced that he wants to share with all of us, especially with younger people. As they are growing up, they're going to be facing some of these things in life. So before he died, he wanted to impart these words. And in chapter 12, in verse 9, he said, "Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth." He goes on to say that these are the words that come from the one shepherd. And the one shepherd, of course, would be God. He is saying that these are words of wisdom that ultimately come from God, and that they are words that he wants to impart to his hearers here, to his listeners as he is speaking. Now, the word preacher here that is used is really the word from which the name Ecclesiastes is drawn, because it is the word that in the Greek language is very similar to the ecclesia, the church, that is found in the New Testament, the called out assembly, the called out body of God's people. And so this word, the Ecclesiastes, meaning the preacher, or the Hebrew word was Koheleth, meaning the preacher or one who gathers the assembly. So he identifies himself in the very first verse as he is wanting to speak here to the people of God, to the assembled people, and he has words for them. So he's not speaking in the capacity of being the king or the powerful position, but he has these words that are important words that all of us need to learn from and see what he has to say to us that can be words of truth for us all. Now in verse 2, he goes there to begin to state what his main theme is. And he says, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Well, you cannot make it much more disturbing than for an opening comment that he opens with that thought as he is speaking about life and observing that it is his finding of observing of life is what he has seen is vanity of vanities. And to put it that way, vanity of vanities is putting it in the form of a superlative, or to the ultimate sense that life is meaningless. And the meaning of the word that is used is that it means breath or vapor or something that is fleeting or passes away very quickly. But from that, it draws the secondary meaning that is empty or meaningless or futile or not satisfying. So he is pointing out, or his thoughts about life are that this is how life is, or he has found life to be vanity or emptiness, or it passes away so quickly and it's gone. So there's a sense of disappointment, a sense of frustration that you have when you think about life. And so in verse 3 he says, "For what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun?" Now, we all look at our life, and there is the fact that we all have to work. And this goes back to the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve sinned and they were driven out from the garden. And God said to man at that time that by the sweat of your brow, you will toil and labor and produce the life support that you will need, but it will come through hard labor. And we understand this, we experience this, but he's saying, what profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? Meaning here on earth, in this earthly life here on earth that we live under the sun, but living it in a material sense of living life here on earth as we see it and as we experience it, what profit does a man have from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? So a person may work hard, and yet it may not profit. It doesn't seem to profit anything. Solomon wrote the Proverbs, and in the Proverbs, he says that we should work diligently. He encourages that. He does not have any sympathy for the lazy person, the slothful person. He talks about that quite a bit in the book of Proverbs, that no, we need to work. We need to work diligently. But here he's saying that you can do all of that and work hard, and yet what does it profit? What do you have to show for it at the end of that, all the work that you have done under the sun, meaning your life here on earth? So again, that enforces the theme that he is starting off there with. And to illustrate this, he goes into begin to talk about some of the cycles of nature that we see recurring here in the world where we live. And beginning in verse 4, he says, "One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again." Well, as we look at the world around us, we see that what he is saying is certainly true, that there is just a cycle that repeats itself in the world. And the sun comes up, and the sun goes down, and the wind goes this way, and then it comes back this way. The rivers run down into the sea, but the sea is not filled up. And so it just keeps on going that way, and nothing ever seems to change. But he says that man himself is caught up in this sense of futility and vanity. The way things are in the world, we're born into this, and we are more or less trapped in that. So we're on the treadmill. We are We cannot get off of this because that's how life is. So he says in verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. So as he looks at life here, he sees this, that in life we are part of this, the way that the world functions and carries on, and it just seems to be monotonous. It seems to be the same thing always happening. Life becomes a drudgery, or it loses the excitement that we have. So all things are full of labor. It's wearisome when we look at it, and our eyes are never satisfied. So we never get to a point in life where we think, I've got enough, that's all I need. We always want something else, and the ear wants to hear something more. So nothing is new and nothing lasts. And when it's all over, then we are quickly forgotten. And other people come and they go through the same thing. So you can see that what he is talking about here is the way life is, and we all can see that being true. We can all relate to that. But he comes back to his starting point, that he talking about himself being king over Israel. He said, I the preacher was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. So as you look at life here, what we begin to, he wants to find wisdom. He was seeking to know wisdom. And Solomon, being king of Israel, was in a position that he was able to devote some of his time to that. Because he was king, the kingdom was prosperous, the kingdom was at peace for the most part. So and God had given him wisdom. Keep in mind that as he began, he prayed and God granted to Solomon wisdom, great wisdom. But he said, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. And so as he looked at this, he said, I have seen that all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. So he describes it this way, that life is like chasing after the wind and grabbing a hold of it. You cannot do it. It's impossible for us to really find wisdom, find all the answers of life, the things that just don't seem to add up, and things that we find frustrating about life. Even if he set his mind to this as being the person that he was, in a position of kingdom and having wealth and having wisdom, and yet he still cannot wrap his hand around this and really be able to give a definitive answer to all of these things. So he says in verse 15, he says that what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. So there are things in life that are impossible to do. You cannot do these things. What is crooked cannot be made straight. And if something is missing, then you can't count it among the things that you're counting. So those are impossibilities. And his point is that when we look at life, it's that way. We never can answer the questions that we would like to have answered to really better understand life. So he said that the search for wisdom that he did could not remove the feeling of futility. His best effort that he had. But not only that, he goes on to say, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So he's saying that as wisdom increases, so does sorrow. That the more wisdom you gain and acquire, the more you begin to see all the grief and sorrow and disappointment that is there in life. One thing about it is that when you know more, you gain wisdom, and you think you have some of the answers, but no one else will listen to what you're saying. And so what good is that? It still comes down to the fact that the problem that you think is there and you have a solution maybe for it, no one is interested in listening to what you have to say about it. Knowing more causes more pain, he's saying. So it's like watching the news. You might think, I'm going to sit down here and watch the news for the next 7 days, and I'm going to have a better understanding what needs to be done. And you get to the end of it, and you're just depressed about the whole thing. We were talking to my brother-in-law, Karen's brother, and he said that he noticed his wife was very depressed, and he couldn't figure out what was wrong. And he noticed that every morning she was watching the Today Show on TV, and then The View right after that on NBC. And he said, look, why don't you just try this for a week? Instead of turning on the TV, just go out and sit on the back porch and listen to the birds. And she came back at the end of the week and she says, I cannot believe it. What has been happening to me? She says, I'm a different person. So sometimes as wisdom increases, so does sorrow. You just find it more and more vexing and disturbing. And you cannot do anything to fix it. Well, that was one approach that he took. But then he turned to another direction that he could find meaning in pleasure and in enjoying luxury and building things that could make a legacy maybe for his memory. So he said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? Now he goes on to say here, he said, I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. Well, in other words, he wanted to sort of conduct an experiment firsthand and look into this, the possibility that through pleasure, because he looked at wisdom, And he found that wisdom, it just made more sorrow. But what about pleasure and mirth? Mirth would be merrymaking or in entertainment or partying. It would be a lighthearted approach to life and looking for the fun and the excitement. But he said this also was vanity. And I said, of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? So it's like a waste of your time. It doesn't really accomplish anything for us to just have fun and party and laugh and all of these things that we can do to sort of get away from the problems. It's like escapism or distracting your mind off of the negative things by thinking that we can have something funny, we can laugh, we can have comedians, we can do these different things, and then I will feel better. But at the end of the day, we still have the same depressing feeling about life. And it's just a waste of time, he says. So pursuing pleasure, he was trying to do this while maintaining wisdom. He wanted to maintain a self-control over himself that with wine, it would not be an excess. It would just, he would taste the wine and he would see if that brings him a feeling of pleasure, but not to let it lose control. So maintaining the wisdom, it would be like a rationally controlled indulgence in his life. He would try that and see if this is good for the sons of men. Is that a good way to live your life? But he says no, he did not find it to be that. So in verse 4, he said, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. Or some footnotes believe that word should be concubines. He said, so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. So Solomon said that he thought that he would undertake some great building projects. And he would build houses and he'd build gardens and pools of water to water the gardens. So he would create sort of a paradise or like a Garden of Eden or like the Bouchard Gardens up in Victoria that is so beautiful. He would create a place like this, and this would create a legacy, and that he would be able to improve life and make a difference and make the world a better place by doing all of these things. So he undertook that, and he had the resources to do it as king. He was in a position to do things like this. So he had servants, even servants born in his home, and those would be considered more loyal, and they grow up in his home, even men servants, women servants, great possessions, wealth, herds and flocks, and all the enjoyments of life, musical instruments, entertainment he had, and the enjoyments, the delights of men. So he had many wives, and he had a harem of wives. In 1 Kings 11, it says that he had 1,000 wives and concubines. He did all of these things, but at the end, he says that he did accomplish more than anyone before him had done. And yet, he had the same feeling at the end, that all was vanity and grasping after the wind. Now, part of the reason for that, he goes on to say in verse 12, he said, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all." Solomon said that he would compare wisdom and folly, these two things. Now, first of all, he had experienced wisdom. In chapter 1 there, he acquired wisdom. But he found that to be disappointing and frustrating. So compare that now with folly and pleasure. And which one is better? Well, he said, "I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness." So when you compare wisdom and folly, there's really no comparison. Wisdom is far superior to folly. But he says they share the same fate. That in the end, both die, and death then means the passing of that person's life and the legacy that they have accomplished. So in the end, the same event happens to them all. "So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise?" He said, "Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die as the fool?" Wisdom is better than folly, but in the end, both die, both are forgotten, nothing changes, life goes on as before, and all the effort and all the hard work and the achievement that he might have accomplished ends up really meaning nothing in the great picture of things. So he says in verse 17, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." So all of his expectations, all of his hopes that he had put in all of this effort and he would try to find meaning in life, he ended up feeling that it's not going to happen. He is not going to be able to solve the problems, to answer all the questions. And all of these expectations that he had that comes crashing down, and so he feels that he just despises life. All the potential, all the hope that he had, "I'm going to make my life count. I'm going to really accomplish something." He began to lose hope of that being even possible. And at the end of the day, you have the grim reaper to deal with. So death is going to come one way or the other in your life. Well, there is one other hope that he had here, and that is that he could leave an inheritance for his son. So he said, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And who knows whether he will be a wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor, in which I toiled, and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. So he thought, if I leave an inheritance to my son, maybe that will be something worthwhile that I can have accomplished with my life. But then he realized, who knows if my son will be wise or a fool? He hasn't worked for these things. If I leave this inheritance for him, I have no guarantee over the legacy that will be left behind, how it will be used, if it will even be appreciated. Maybe it will actually cause more harm. So it is a vanity there. And he says that all his days are sorrowful and his work is burdensome. So he goes through your life and you work hard and your life is filled with this toil and burdensome labor. And even in the night, his heart takes no rest, because at night he's just mulling over this and thinking back over, what am I going to do tomorrow? What is my next work that I need to do? And so you cannot even get a good night's rest in all the work that he says a man has to do. So what do you do in your life? What is the answer to your life? And so he comes down to this final conclusion that he makes here. And this is one of several conclusions that he eventually comes to, the final, ultimate, at the end of the book in chapter 12. But notice that he does find a way to live your life here. That is the best approach to living your life. He said, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. This is a gift of God, a blessing from God, if you can live your life this way. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So he acknowledges the fact here that what the best approach to life is going to be for us all is to embrace the present. Learn to live in the present and enjoy each day that God gives us. It's a blessing from God. It's a gift of God. And rather than becoming a workaholic and working yourself to the bone and trying to build wealth and a legacy, he's just saying, no, work enough that you have what you need to eat and drink. And then enjoy life with your wife and family. And look at each day that this is a gift from God, that God is blessing me, God has been good to me, and that God takes the things that the wicked person makes and earns, and he actually gives those to the person who honors God. He the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. The Bible teaches that God blesses those who are righteous, and that God is able to take those things that the wicked stores up and actually bless us in many different ways. But the point is that the purpose of life is to enjoy life as a simple blessing that we have from God. To recognize God. This is the first time that he even mentioned God here in the book. He acknowledged the fact God is the one who gives us life. We need to live life to have that wisdom and knowledge and joy that comes from the fact that we live our lives as a blessing from God, rather than trying to store up or experience all the meaning of life that in some kind of an existential journey that we go on. I've got to figure out who I am and all of these, what my life means. Just accept the fact that we are here as God created us, and God is blessing us that we have enough to eat and food and clothing to feed our family. Enjoy the day. Enjoy your life with your family and with your friends that God has blessed us with, because that is the nothing better that a man can do than to approach his life that way. So much of what Solomon is saying is frustrating, it's pessimistic, it seems to be, but it's realistic. He is talking about life as he experienced it. And this is, whether we like it or not, that's how life is when we live here under the sun and we don't consider that God is the one who created us and put us here. Ultimately, the answer to life comes from when we see life is something God has created. He's blessed us with life. He doesn't intend for us to store up all this stuff here on earth. He intends for us to enjoy our life and to be able to take it as a simple blessing and thank him for that and live to serve and honor him. So enjoy today. Enjoy what you have. And satisfaction isn't going to come through chasing after the wind. It's found with the Lord being in the center of your life. Thank you for your attention today. We're going to stand and sing the invitation. And if there are those, anyone who is here today needs to respond and come to Christ and obedience to the gospel, we invite you to do that as we stand together and sing the invitation.
Sunlit morning, when this life is o'er, I'll fly away, fly away, fly away to a home on God's celestial shore. I'll fly.